content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, Why I Hate Sports But Love the Olympics, by Gisela Salim Payer. Many people love sports, but I am not one of them. I don't want to play any sports, and I certainly don't want to watch. And yet, I will be enthusiastically tuning in to the Paris 2024 Olympics this summer. Once every 2 years, I summon Olympic fervor that surprises the men in my life, the ones I automatically tune out when they start talking about the Yankees or Real Madrid. You can't get me to care about the NBA, but I just might wake up early to watch the women's 3-meter springboard diving semifinals. NBC counts the Olympics as one of only two major sporting events that reliably attract more female viewers than male viewers. The American Olympic audience is about 55% female and 45% male, an exact flip of the Super Bowl's gender split. Surely one reason so many women watch the Olympics is that so many women compete in the Olympics. The Paris 2024 Summer Games advertise themselves as the first ever to achieve 50-50 gender parity. That's a fair bit of progress, especially compared with the very first Olympics. In ancient Greece, women weren't allowed to cross the river of Alpheios into Olympia to even watch the games, lest they catch a glimpse of male athletes competing in the nude. According to legend, a daughter of Diagoras of Rhodes, there is some confusion over whether it was Phrynike or Calipatria, was caught dressing as a man in order to sneak in. Barred from competing herself, she had coached her son, a boxer, and when he won a match, she couldn't contain her excitement. As she jumped over the fence separating her from the ring, she inadvertently revealed her womanhood. The authorities exempted her from the punishment of being thrown off a high cliff because she pleaded that she was merely supporting the men in her life, her father, her brothers, and her son, all Olympic athletes. More than two millennia later, certain attitudes lingered. In 1894, when Baron Pierre de Coubertin presented his idea for a revival of the ancient Olympic Games, he conjured a grand vision of inclusivity in terms of social class and nationality, but not gender. Zero women participated in the inaugural Athens 1896 Olympics. As of Mexico City 1968, just one in seven athletes was a woman. Even so, most of the women who made sports history in the first half of the 20th century did so in the Olympics. Alice Coachman, for example, a black woman from Georgia, won a gold medal in the high jump in London in 1948 and the congratulations of President Harry Truman at the White House. The only prominent women's sports league to emerge in the United States before 1950 was the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League of 1946, and that was only because the war had kept would-be sportsmen busy. When women did begin to compete in sports leagues, media attention didn't follow. The Center for Feminist Research at the University of Southern California has been tracking gender asymmetries in sports coverage on ESPN and network news channels from 1989 to 2019. Not much has changed. Even last year, as Caitlin Clark's ascent brought unprecedented interest to women's basketball, another report found that women's athletics accounted for just 15% of total sports coverage. Except at the Olympics. Since the 2012 London Games, women athletes have gotten more airtime than men have. In the 2020 Tokyo Games, held for pandemic reasons in 2021, NBC gave 58% of the primetime screen to women, according to a paper published in the International Journal of Sport Communications. call this a representation theory of why women love the Olympics. Put women on TV and female audiences will watch. But that explanation only goes so far. Unsporty eggheads like me don't care about non-Olympic sports, regardless of the sex of the participants. For me, the WNBA holds no more appeal than the NBA. So what do I see in the Olympics? First, it must be said that I see pageantry and good outfits. Recall that the Olympics are one of two major sporting events on NBC that draw more female viewers than male. The other is the Kentucky Derby, an ostentatious hat convention that happens to take place beside a horse race. I can't be alone in watching the Olympics partly to see what Stella McCartney designed for the British team and to gawk at the spectacle of equestrian jumps in Versailles. Second, I see a competition that more closely resembles the worlds in which women feel comfortable and thrive. I've already started generalizing wildly about half the human race, so let me keep going. Women tend to do better in school than men, and the Olympics, with their elitism, insistence on classic Greek origins, and stuffy corrupt bureaucracies, have a lot in common with academia. In many marquee Olympic events, such as figure skating, athletes literally get grades. Women are also shown in polls to be more supportive than men of multilateral organizations, and the International Olympic Committee is basically the United Nations of sports. Women also visit museums and art galleries more than men do, according to visitor data. The Olympics offers a synthesized, highly curated overview, one might say exhibition, of every imaginable sport. Finally, I see an idea of athletic achievement that has more to do with excellence than with dominating an opponent. When people say they love watching sports, they usually mean sports with balls, football, basketball. Sports with balls, or in the case of hockey, pucks, close enough, are zero sum. You cannot play soccer or tennis without an opponent, and you can succeed only at their expense, not merely by outperforming them, but by causing them to fail. These are not only sports, they are also games, socially constructed contests that produce winners and losers, a quality that excites crowds and that are based on ultimately arbitrary rules. During the Olympic season, the ball sports that are usually monopolize media attention lose importance. The Olympics may be called the games, but what sets them apart is that they showcase sports that are not, in fact, games. Artistic expressions such as gymnastics and figure skating, races such as track and field and swimming, sports that are not only sports but also survival skills or dances. You play soccer or volleyball, but you do not play running or swimming or skiing. You simply run, swim, or ski. These activities present not a problem to solve or an opponent to overcome, so much as a test of what the human body can do. Citius Altius Fortius is the Olympic slogan, faster, higher, stronger. Part of what draws me, an otherwise sports-averse woman, to the Olympics is the pursuit of perfection that is not intrinsically competitive. Of course, Olympic athletes are trying to win. Not everyone gets a medal. But runners and swimmers and so on aren't bound to their opponents in the same way that ball sport players are. Anita de France, an American bronze medalist for rowing in the Montreal 1976 Olympics, told me that her coach always instructed the team to forget the boats they were racing against, to keep their eyes on the lane. This proved hard because she wanted to win. And indeed, she sometimes couldn't stop herself from peeking at the other boats during the competition. But she was at her best when she followed her coach's advice and focused her attention on the act itself. It's the thrill of the boat when it's up to speed, winding up in the water, and you can hear the bubbles running down, she said, and when it's going that fast, there's nothing like it. De France has dedicated her life to sports, not just as an athlete, but as a member of the International Olympic Committee, which she joined in 1986, the first black person and the first woman to do so. She wrote a memoir called my Olympic life. But De France doesn't seem to care for sports besides the niche Olympic ones. When I asked her whether she followed any ball sports, where she diplomatically said that she rooted for all the professional teams of Los Angeles, where she lives, but has no time to follow them. I found her indifference inspiring. Finally, an athlete I can look up to. Our second article from the Planet section of the Atlantic is entitled California's Fire Luck Just Ran Out by Carolyn Mims Nice. For 2 years, the fire gods cut California a break. The winter rains came down heavy and brought the state's years-long drought to an end. Plants started growing again. Grasses were green. The poppies bloomed larger than normal. For a while, living here meant seeing the place's better nature, going outside and exploring the mountains and lakes and vineyards without thinking of breathing in toxic smoke plumes. The apoplectic scenes of 2020 and 2021 receded like a bad dream. Any worries about fire were a problem of the past or the future. Then the heat came and the green faded. Plants died. People who know where to look started to see the warning signs. Now when David Acuna, a battalion chief at Cal Fire, walks around his local area, he sees layers of grass, standing grass, but also the remnants of previous years' grasses. They are just waiting to burn, he told me. Wildfire is cyclical, and wet years can set up future ones for worst fires. Even when the landscape is lush and healthy, California is operating on borrowed time. This week, the fire came roaring back. California's first major fire in 3 years is burning. The Park Fire, located near the city of Chico in Northern California, started Wednesday and grew quickly, tripling in size in a single day. By this morning, the blaze, which started when a man allegedly rolled a burning car into a gully, had spread across more than 300,000 acres and was 0% contained. Already it is one of the 10 largest recorded fires in California history, and it is moving extremely fast. We had our fire grow by 120,000 acres in a single day, Acuna said. That is not normal. Fire is a natural part of California's ecosystem and can help clear space for new plant life. But in the past 10 years, the combination of dry fuels, hot temperatures, and winds have made for more explosive fire growth, according to Dan Macon, a UC Cooperative Extension livestock and natural resources advisor who monitors the grass conditions in the area just south of where the park fire is. When I was a kid, a big fire was 5,000 acres, he told me. Abnormally hot weather, in particular, may be helping feed bigger and more violent fires. One paper tried to isolate the role of climate change in California's wildfires over the past 50 years and found that human-caused warming was responsible for almost all of the increase in acreage burnt. Those exact dynamics seem to be driving the current fire. California's two consecutive wet springs in 2023 and 2024 left the state with a lot of extra vegetation, or as wildfire experts call it, fuel. Extreme heat early this summer dried all that fuel out. One heat wave around the 4th of July drove temperatures up to or past 110 degrees in parts of the state. Conditions are bad right now, and fire activity has picked up accordingly. The state's five-year average for acres burned by this time of year is about 117,000 acres, Acuna said. This year, some 467,000 acres, more than three times what's normal, have already been scorched. Matthew Shamison, a meteorologist at the U.S. Forest Service, told me he and his colleagues expect above-average fire activity to continue for much of the state through September. None of that means that this particular fire at this particular time was inevitable. Last year could have been a bad one, Acuna told me as he braced for that, but it ended up being relatively quiet. California got lucky, and even the biggest fires can start by chance. The majority of wildfires in the U.S. are caused by humans, as is in the case of the Park Fire, though in many cases the spark is less dramatic, a runaway campfire or a misplaced cigarette butt. The second biggest cause is lightning. The odds that California and the rest of the West get any lucky breaks this year seem low. It's only July. National firefighting resources are already strained, and we've still got a lot of dry, hot weather ahead of us, Macon pointed out. People living in the West know to expect fire, even if we try to forget it during green seasons and years of reprieve. But the breaks always end. The Park Fire is eerily close to the site of the Camp Fire, which killed 85 people in 2018. Parts of Paradise, a town that's still recovering from that fire, are under evacuation warning. Just this week, two other fires burned through Canada's Jasper National Park, where people flock to bathe in impressive forests and cliffsides to feel humbled by the marvels around them. Living in this part of the world means living amid beauty, and it means forever waiting for the moment when all that beauty goes up in smoke. Next, about every 500 years, a major quake body slams Middle America, by Frida Cryer. This article was originally published in Undark magazine. The first earthquake struck while the town was still asleep. Around 2 a.m. on December 16, 1811, residents of New Madrid, a small frontier settlement of 400 people in what is now southeastern Missouri, were jolted awake. Panicked town folk fled their homes as buildings collapsed and the smell of sulfur filled the air. The episode didn't last long, but the worst was yet to come. Nearly 2 months later, after dozens of aftershocks and another massive quake, the fault line running directly under the town ruptured. Eliza Bryan, a 31-year-old resident, watched in horror as the Mississippi River receded and swept away boats full of people. In nearby fields, geysers of sand erupted, and a rumble filled the air. By the end, the town had dropped around 15 feet. Bryan and others spent a year and a half living in makeshift camps while they waited for the aftershocks to end. 4 years later, the shocks had become less common. At last, the rattled townspeople began to hope that ere long they will cease entirely, Bryan wrote in a letter. Whether Bryan's hope will stand the test of time is an open question. The U.S. Geological Survey released a report in December of 2023 detailing the risk of dangerous earthquakes around the country. As expected on the hazard map, deep red risk lines run through California and Alaska. But the map also spots a big bullseye in the middle of the country, right over New Madrid. The USGS estimates that the region has a 25 to 40% chance of a magnitude 6.0 or stronger earthquake in the next 50 years, and as much as a 10% chance of a repeat of the 1811-1812 sequence. Although the risk is much lower compared with, say, parts of California, experts say that when it comes to earthquake resistance, the New Madrid seismic region suffers from inadequate building codes and infrastructure. Caught in this seismic splash zone are millions of people living across five states, mostly in Tennessee and Missouri, as well as Kentucky, Illinois, and Arkansas, and two major cities, Memphis and St. Louis. Mississippi, Alabama, and Indiana have also been noted as places of concern. In response to the potential for calamity, geologists have learned a lot about this odd earthquake hotspot over the past few decades. Yet one mystery has persisted: why earthquakes even happen here in the first place. This is a problem, experts say, without a clear mechanism for why the New Madrid area experiences earthquakes. Scientists are still struggling to answer some of the most basic questions, such as when or even if another large earthquake will strike the region. In Missouri today, earthquakes are not as front of mind as other natural disasters, says Jeff Briggs, the earthquake program manager for the Missouri State Emergency Management Agency. But when the next big strike shake comes, he says, it's going to be the biggest natural disaster this state has ever experienced. Sizing up earthquake risk isn't easy, especially when a seismic zone is smack dab in the middle of a tectonic plate. Up until recently, the 1811 and 1812 quakes were considered freak events, says Marticia Tuttle, a paleoseismologist at M. Tuttle & Associates, an earthquake risk consulting company. Earthquakes occur when subterranean strain that was building for centuries is released in seconds. That usually happens near plate tectonic boundaries where massive plates rub against each other. But exceptions happen. For instance, New York area was jolted by a sudden seismic shock in April, despite being thousands of miles from the closest plate boundary. But just because areas such as New York are far from a plate boundary today doesn't mean that was always the case, and many regions have the scars to prove it. Researchers have mapped out three currently active ancient fault lines, fissures in the Earth's crust in the New Madrid area. Now these fault lines form weak zones where stress in the earth can build and eventually break into earthquakes. Why these fault lines are seismically active, yet neighboring ones aren't, is less clear. It's usually one of the most enigmatic seismic zones on the planet, says Eric Sandoval, a seismologist at the University of Missouri. We're not supposed to have earthquakes here. Scientists have suggested that the movement of the North American plate westward is driving stress, or that the Earth bounding back from the crush of massive glaciers during the Ice Age is to blame. Some have also pointed to a pillow-shaped rock under the seismic zone as a factor. But researchers simply don't have a smoking gun stress source and are unlikely to anytime soon, explains Ancio Choi, a geophysicist at the Center for Earthquake Research and Information at the University of Memphis. That matters because measuring stress buildup is a great way to predict earthquake hazards. The telltale ripping of earth along the surface, a sign of a stress buildup, is easy to see in places such as California, where tectonic plates meet. Yet until recently, researchers working in the New Madrid area weren't even able to prove that the ground in the region was moving at all. The lack of obvious stress buildup led some scientists to suggest that New Madrid might not be gearing up for another earthquake. Yet in 2015, scientists published data that showed that the ground near the fault lines was in fact creeping, albeit slowly. With modern technology, people can look at celestial bodies light years away, Choi says. But ironically, we don't really see that well just a few kilometers down from our surface. On a cloudy day in May, the geologist Roy Van Arksdale is driving on top of the Real Foot Fault Line in western Tennessee. The Mississippi River Valley extends on terrain as flat as Kansas for miles. Only some towns have the slightest bit of elevation. Settlers in the region built anywhere they could to escape the annual spring floods. In New Madrid, that meant building where earthquakes had uplifted the earth. Van Arsdale pulled off the main road to park behind a prison complex, at odds with the rest of the countryside. A long linear mound of earth juts out from beneath a prison fence and into a neighboring cornfield. It's the fault line. If another major earthquake were to happen, Van Arsdale says, they'd be in trouble. Van Arsdale has spent his career trying to understand why the region experiences earthquakes. In the 1970s, the nuclear power industry planned on building power plants along the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, but the specter of the 1911 and 1912 quakes raised concerns. So geologists like Van Arsdale were brought in to try to reconstruct the area's seismic history. When Van Arsdale and other research groups dug into this fault line decades ago, they found traces of the 1811 and 1812 quakes, as well as older ruptures dating back to the 15th and 10th centuries. This work helped reveal that the New Madrid seismic zone has popped out major earthquakes of 7.0 magnitude or greater every 500 years or so for the past five millennia. Work by other researchers on sand blows, those geysers of sand that Brian saw in 1812, revealed that the 1811-1812 pattern of three earthquakes hitting one right after the other wasn't an aberration. The seismic events of the 15th and the 10th centuries also likely involved major quakes, one right after another. This research suggests that another major set of quakes was possible, and that if one happened, the area should expect two or more in quick succession, Van Arsdale says. A rough span of 500 years between major earthquake events potentially puts a lot of time before the next big one. But many experts say the region is still largely unprepared for even moderate shaking. Many parts of Alaska, which experiences large quakes more frequently, put in strict building codes after an earthquake devastated the state in 1964. Those building codes are thought to be why Anchorage survived a 7.0 earthquake in 2018, with only minimal damage and no deaths. In contrast, many states in the New Madrid region began including earthquake provisions in their building codes only in the early 2000s, meaning anything built prior to that is prone to collapse. That has experts worried. Human bodies don't stand up well to falling building parts, says Chris Kramer, a geophysicist who works on earthquake hazards at the Center for Earthquake Research and Information at the University of Memphis. He estimates that a major earthquake near New Madrid would cost the U.S. an average of $10 billion a year for 100 years from damaged buildings and lost infrastructure. For an aging Memphis, which is only roughly 40 miles from the southern edge of one fault line, even a moderate earthquake could cause considerable damage. St. Louis is another city near the bullseye. Memphis and St. Louis have started to retrofit bridges in preparation. Newer buildings, especially taller ones, are built with shaking in mind. But while progress has been made, there's still a considerable way to go to ensure the resilience of buildings and infrastructure. Alicia Tate Nadeau, the director of the Illinois Emergency Management Agency and Office of Homeland Security, wrote, "To deal with this, the state has adopted international building codes with seismic provisions, but these won't become mandatory across Illinois until 2025. We know from research and past events that we're capable of having large earthquakes in this area again, and at any time. Our job, regardless of the mechanism that causes earthquakes, is to prepare." We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.